I injected myself with it.
Is your, your production's going up?
My production's sky high, yeah.
Which is why he supports this case.
So the state of Vermont said, you know, they did something, you know, not very radical, but they said, we want all products that use BGH to be labeled. We're going to pass a law that requires them to be labeled so consumers can decide whether or not to buy the product. The International Dairy Foods Association, on behalf of the grocery retailers, came in and sued the state, contending that the labeling law violated the corporation's right not to speak. That it was compelled speech. And under the First Amendment, whereas there's a right to speak, there's also a right not to be compelled to speak. The court struck the labeling law, holding that the corporations had a right not to speak and therefore overturned the law. That's 96. Once again, it's not the exception, it's the rule. This is the way things work. Connie.
In the state of Vermont, there was an organic dairyman who used a label on his questions that said that there was no BH, no bovine growth hormone in his milk. And Monsanto again intervened and sued and said that they were implying that the regular milk was bad by definition because it did use the bovine growth hormone.
But in New York, the Burn Dairy has milk, and there's some other retailers upstate New York with no RBH in it.
Yeah, but it's voluntary placement of, you know, little slogan certified, no RBST on it.
But my point is that the same corporation used something in reverse then, you know, to sue, you know, so it's just a game of which amendment fits today.
And who protects who, and who wields the Constitution against who. Right. Because literally, this is our own document, founding document, Declaration of Independence specifically, and the ideals underneath the Constitution that were driven in by blood.
Right.
It was driven in by blood, by real people, real living, breathing people, that has somehow been hijacked to be used against the layer of people that need that are working to protect their communities and doing that type of thing. So.
You're listening to Tom Lindsay of CellDef speaking at the Finger Lakes Democracy School. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. For Finger Lakes listeners, a reminder that the trial referred to in the program of the peace activists, the St. Patrick's Day 4, begins tomorrow, Monday, September 19th. At 9 a.m. at the federal courthouse in Binghamton. The defendants are facing serious charges for acting against the immoral oil war, and supporters in the courtroom are important. Note, a driver's license or similar ID is needed to gain access to the courthouse. For more info on the trial and Citizens Tribunal in the evening after court, see stpatricks4.org, stpatricks4.org, or call area code 607-651-9109, 651-9109. We return to the conclusion of Democracy School with Tom Lindsay.
The fact is that activists were used to it being our fault somehow. That when we go up against something and we lose, it's almost like a guilt thing, that we didn't do everything we could do, because how could we not win in a country that's supposed to be based on these values that are codified in the Constitution? But in reality, it's no surprise that we ended up where we are, because the Constitution is a property document. It protects property over people and property over communities. It was written that way on purpose, mainly because the 20% of the white males with property who wrote the Constitution were scared shitless of the other 80% of the people in the country taking property and doing those things. I mean, Alexander Hamilton was well known for going in and giving speeches to groups of bankers. And in one of them, he said, "The people," he said, "gentlemen, the people are a beast." That's the kind of speeches he used to give. And so the Constitution, we have a Commerce Clause, a Contracts Clause. In reality, the courts are applying it the way the founders envisioned, the folks that wrote it envisioned, which means that we're not crazy because we're in a legal framework that was intended to eviscerate the power of community from the start. And that's a really tough concept for me to grasp over the last 8 years, that somehow the Constitution prefigured everything. But it really did when you follow the strands out. And a lot of what the corporations have done is simply following the intent of those words in some of those sections.
And I think the trap that we don't want to be caught in is this, well, you know, we have to follow the Constitution. It's supposed to be a living document, and we should be able to make it evolve into something better, something that meets the image we've tried to portray of ourselves.
And what's much more terrifying to folks is to think that not only do we not have a democracy, that we don't live in one, but we don't even know what one looks like. And that's pretty scary for a lot of people to come to grips with.
But the vision of Franklin, Jefferson, and Paine was different than Hamilton's vision. And it may not have been totally democratic, but it gives, that's the strand that we can cling to at least.
By means of the American Revolution, colonists took sovereignty from the English monarchy and invested it in themselves. Emerging triumphant from their struggle with King George and Parliament, they decided they would figure out how to govern themselves. Alas, a minority of colonists were united and wealthy enough to define most of the human beings in the 13 colonies as property or as non-persons before the law and within the society with no rights any legal person was bound to respect. Ours was a terribly screwed up sovereignty from the beginning. Because of this immoral, atrocious, structural mess, whole classes of people had to organize and struggle over centuries to gain recognition as part of the sovereign people. That is, they had to get strong enough as a class to define themselves and not let other people or institutions define them. African Americans, Native peoples, women, debtors, indentured servants, and immigrants. To this day, many still must struggle to exercise the rights of persons to be recognized as persons by law and by society. And once again, to put a fine point on the American Revolution, private corporations, constitutionalized states, huge change between the two. Skipping over to the piece after the one that you have next, over to page 84, to put a fine point on the anti-federalists and their work in driving the Bill of Rights into the Constitution. And halfway down page 84, this, of course, is not what the wealthy landed men who helped lead the revolution had in mind. They were, after all, a small minority of 20%. European and colonial class structures had already defined the majority, women, slaves, native peoples, indentured servants, and workers in general, as non-legal persons, indeed as property. So in self-defense, Washington, Hamilton, Madison, and other leaders of the minority wrote and fixed in place a constitution, quote, to contain the threat of the people rather than to embrace their participation and their competence, committed to, quote, preventing popular liberty from destroying itself, because the anarchy of the propertyless would give way to despotism. They made it extremely difficult for the majority to use the Constitution to make basic changes in law, even if and when they should ever win the civil and political rights of persons. In addition, these Federalist founders defined decisions about investment, production, labor, and technology as private properties' rights. They believed such decisions were proper matters only for the wealthy landed gentry and commercial class, or the corporate managers of today. Accordingly, at the 1787 Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, Federalist delegates maneuvered a leap from the Articles of Confederation, which had kept power and authority in state legislatures, to a totally new constitution erecting a powerful central government. In the Constitution's Commerce Clause, they forbade majorities through state legislatures from making rules for production, commerce, and trade. And to appointed Supreme Court justices, they gave the authority of kings. Further down that column, it talks about the meeting of the delegates in Philadelphia. Once behind closed doors, they replaced the articles with a new plan and denied the public any details about their deliberations for 53 years. Their constitution turned a cooperative venture among sovereign states into a setup where Congress would decide commerce, an unelected Senate would approve treaties, a Supreme Court would dictate the law of the land, and an indirectly elected president would command a standing army. On page 85, just to finish this piece out, talks about the anti-federalists, and there were very strong anti-federalists from New York as well as from Pennsylvania, and a rich literature on the anti-federalists. It says, overpowered and outmaneuvered by the Federalist founders, critics of the Constitution yielded when promised a Bill of Rights. And then Richard went off on NAFTA, saying, with spotlights on global production and trade deals revealing our Constitution as the first NAFTA, our Bill of Rights stands exposed as the first diversionary side agreement. This is because just as the labor and environmental side agreements did not alter NAFTA's basic undemocratic design, the Bill of Rights did nothing to change the very specific language of the Constitution, which empowered the property minority to rule. That brings us to the abolitionists. We're going to go slightly out of order. I made the joke earlier that the abolitionists were not asking for the establishment of a slavery protection agency. No slavery protection agency. Jack corrected me and said, actually, in the beginning, there were folks that wanted a slavery protection agency. Absolutely right. William Lloyd Garrison was not one of those folks. He was the radical abolitionist. And just to play this out at the top of page 87, says, until Garrison began publishing The Liberator, most people who opposed slavery were working for gradual emancipation. They tried to convince individual slave owners to free their slaves, for example, or they were part of the colonization movement, which advocated funding the expatriation of ex-slaves and free blacks to Africa. Garrison's opposition to slavery, and the abolitionist's opposition to slavery as a movement, was so great that he even condemned the U.S. Constitution, which protected slavery, as a covenant with death and an agreement with hell. He used to burn the Constitution when he went out to speak. To burn the Constitution because it was a document that protected and enabled slavery. As a reward for his efforts, he was dragged through Boston Commons by the neck by folks that hauled him off from the speaking lectern, put a noose around his neck, and dragged him behind two horses across Boston Common. That was Massachusetts. Was in the South, Massachusetts. So we use these pieces, the anti-federalists, the abolitionists, we're going to look at the populists, Vicky's going to talk about the women's rights movement, as for the very specific reason to show that these movements operated under different strategies and tactics, under different structures than a regulatory organizing approach. When you look at Garrison's stuff, it's very clear that he doesn't feel locked into a regulatory approach. Because when you read this stuff, you know, the Susan B. Anthony's piece and the anti-federalist stuff, they invoke the core founding principles of this country, the Declaration of Independence primarily. So halfway down the page of Garrison's piece on 87, he says, you know, I determined at every hazard to lift up the standard of emancipation in the eyes of the nation, quote, within sight of Bunker Hill and in the birthplace of liberty. At the bottom, he talks about assenting to the self-evident truth maintained in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal and endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Best quote from the inaugural editorial that you're looking at on page 88 is on the back of first paragraph, where he writes, I am aware that many object to the severity of my language, but is there not cause for severity? I will be as harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice. On the subject, I do not wish to think or to speak or write with moderation. No, no. Tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hands of the ravisher. Tell the mother to gradually extricate her babe from the fire into which it has fallen. But urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch. And I will be heard. The apathy of the people is enough to make every statute leap from its pedestal and to hasten the resurrection of the dead. It is pretended that I am retarding the cause of emancipation by the coarseness of my invective and the precipitancy of my measures. The charge is not true. The next piece, which is Howard J. Graham's piece, wrote a book called Every Man's Constitution. Tracks the Constitution and rights, how those rights were exercised, especially by the abolitionist movement. Just to give hope to folks, because the morning session on Saturday is probably one of the most discouraging sessions that anybody can ever sit through. It's like, oh, shit. You know, now I really know why we're getting screwed, and I really didn't want to know that much about why it was. Now, really, really know. Graham writes about the early abolitionist movement. Okay, he writes about this session in 1834. It actually started with students at a place called Lane Seminary in Cincinnati. Keeping in mind, this is over 30 years prior to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments being driven into the Constitution. Over 30 years prior to those amendments being driven into the Constitution. There was a 45-hour conference held at Lane Seminary by the students to discuss basically one question. Ought the people of the slaveholding states to abolish slavery immediately? And this is on page 90 of your materials, actually unmarked, but page 166 of the book itself, Graham's book. And he talks about what these folks got for their 45-hour discussion that these students decided to hold at Lane Seminary. They got kicked out. They got kicked out of Lane Seminary. There was a suppression of the anti-slavery society on campus. Right before there was a formal order actually kicking them out, 51 students withdrew from Lane Seminary, led by Weld, who's one of the most famous radical abolitionists. Where did they go? They went to Oberlin College. They moved en masse to Oberlin, which is where Oberlin gets a reputation as the founding place of the abolition movement. Yes. Yeah. Say again. And what they wrote when they left was a manifesto that they penned to the seminary saying why they were leaving. And essentially, and it's quoted here, it says, "Free discussion, they insisted in a parting manifesto penned by Weld, was not merely a right, inherent and inalienable. It was the duty of every rational being and free moral agent." And so in the spring of 1835, almost the entire group, transferred to Oberlin College. At that point, the abolitionist movement, for folks tracking the movement, was 12 people. They were called the 12 Rebels. And the 12 Rebels grew to include a group called the 70. This was 70 people. Okay? 12 people, essentially, where the abolition movement came from. Graham tracks those 70 into the larger movement that eventually became the abolitionists. And he calls it on page 168 of the book itself, towards the bottom of the main text, a prophetic constitutional attack on slavery. And then he broke that down as to exactly how the movement took form and what the themes were within the movement. At the top of 169, he talks about an original ethico-moral religious indictment that gave way to one framed increasingly in legal and constitutional terms. He writes that the whole anti-slavery crusade was essentially a quest for protection of the law. Its central theme and argument derived from the self-evident truths of the Declaration of Independence, not the mere excesses or abuses of the slave system. Okay? Parallel to excesses and abuses of the corporate system that folks try through the regulatory system to change those behaviors or abuses. Number two, what thus began as a campaign for protection of slaves and free Negroes presently became one to guarantee civil liberties more generally. Just give me a sentence. They were interested not merely in their own rights, but also in those of other dissident and unpopular groups, including Indians and Mormons, are the history of the abolitionists that we usually don't read about. Number three, on the next page, Graham writes, setting out from these bases, abolitionists eventually employed almost every conceivable clause from the preamble to the Bill of Rights. They eventually merged into and buttressed the three original primary concepts of protection, freedom, and equality grounded on the Declaration of Independence. So over 30 years before the Joint Congressional Committee began its labors to draft the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments after the Civil War, these folks were essentially writing those amendments already. In other words, they were building a movement around certain themes that were essentially writing those amendments before those folks ever sat down in the Joint Congressional Committee to actually codify those amendments. And he talks about, of course, Western Pennsylvania, Ohio, and New York, districts in which Bingham, Giddings, Bliss, Granger, and Stevens, later representative of Congress, some of the key radical abolitionists, that what started was this evangelical humanitarian movement that blossomed into a constitutional movement to seek protection of the Constitution. not only for slaves in the South, but also in the North, just being able to talk about slavery was a crime, as evidenced by the expulsion of the folks from Lane Seminary in Cincinnati.
Okay. The Declaration of Women's Rights was done by Susan B. Anthony on the 4th of July, on the anniversary of the 100th year of our existence, in front of Independence Hall, under the shadow of Washington's statue. It's a really fiery speech. I'm going to go through this really quick, and I'm hoping that all of you will read it. We have an annual party at our house on the 4th of July every year, and I've decided that I'm going to read this whole thing next year to the people that are assembled at my house, and they're going to have to listen. But it's really awesome.
Before you feed them.
Right. And the reason it's important is because understanding how these movements were built means that we have to tie back to our history, the history of this fight for human rights. Okay, the most important thing is that for all of this first 100 years of our country, women didn't have any, on the second page of this, which it's 94 on your book, for all of these 100 years, women did not have any of these rights. And that includes the First Amendment for the natural rights of each individual, the Second Amendment, the equality of these rights, the Third Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the Bill of Attainder has, she said, the males all, the Bill of Attainder have been passed by the introduction of the word male into all the state constitutions, denying women the right of suffrage and thereby making sex a crime. An exercise of the power clearly forbidden in Article 1, Section 9 and 10 of the U.S. Constitution. The writ of habeas corpus, the right of trial by a jury of one's peers, was so jealously guarded that states refused to ratify the original Constitution until it was guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. And yet women of this nation have never been allowed a jury of their peers. Being tried in all cases by men, native and foreign, educated and ignorant, virtuous and vicious. Young girls have been arraigned in the courts for the crime of infanticide, tried, convicted, and hanged, victims perchance of judge, jurors, and advocates, while no woman's voice could be heard in their defense. Skipping down, taxation without representation, the immediate cause of the rebellion of the colonies against Great Britain is one of the grievous wrongs of the women in this country who suffered during this century. Deploring war with all the demoralization that follows in its train, we have been taxed to support standing armies with their waste of life and wealth. Believing in temperance, we have been taxed to support the vice, crime, and pauperism of the liquor traffic. Next down, unequal codes for men and women held by law a perpetual minor. Special legislation for women has placed us in a most anomalous position. Women invested with the right of citizens in one section, voters, jurors, office holders, crossing an imaginary line are subjects in the next. On the next page, 96, I'm going to skip down some of this. The judiciary above the nation has, in that sentence, in that paragraph, at the very bottom, such interpretations of constitutional law unsettle our faith in the judicial authority and undermine the liberties of the whole people. Over on the last page of this, it says, the recognition of a governing and governed class is incompatible with the first principles of freedom. We ask of our rulers at this hour no special favors, no special privileges, no special legislation. We ask justice, we ask equality, we ask that all the civil and political rights that belong to citizens of the United States be guaranteed to us and our daughters forever. No one is free if we aren't all free. And this gets us back to the few versus the many again. It took 44 years after this speech before these rights were driven into the Constitution with the 19th Amendment. And all of this built on the basic fundamental rights not to make servitude just a little bit better. And it ties together all the constitutional provisions, and that we can't be a democratic republic if women don't have rights. I wish I could have been there. It's a fiery speech.
Questions? Maura?
I just wanted to comment that it's so polite, and it starts out with an apology for bothering anybody. Sorry that you and your nice sports have allowed come to your celebration. Which is, I mean, it's just a lesson. It's too nice. And women have a tendency to want to apologize for bothering you.
It was 1876.
I know, but we still do it. That's my point. We're still too polite. We don't want to disturb people.
There's a movie called Iron Jawed Angels. Mm-hmm. Over there, everyone. Yeah, very good movie. It's about the young Turks in the women's rights movement who came up and basically overthrew the old governance of the women's rights movement. It's great.
Yeah. We're showing it in our Green Card film series at the Corning Library running in October.
Great.
Yeah. Very good, very good film. David.
She mentioned not taxation without representation because of gender in that situation. And I would say that if you flash forward today, if you're not a corporation, you're being taxed without representation.
Well, that's because they don't tax corporations.
I was just going to say in response to Maura, I take the point, but I also think this was a rhetorical device. If you know who's the great black leader from Rochester? Frederick Douglass gave a wonderful speech on the 4th of July in which he starts with an apology.
Right. I'm sure in the voice, there wasn't all that much nice, but in the written word, it seems right away.
Okay, take a deep breath. Because we're going to do the populace in 5 minutes, essentially.
Oh my God.
We have two parts of the populace. We're actually going to have a populace speak to you directly. His name is Hiram Simonton. He's from North Carolina. And the tape is essentially going to cover some of the same stuff that we're going to cover. I'm going to do this, and then we're going to go to the videotape, and the videotape overlaps with this and essentially gives you the story of one farmer who went through this process in the populist movement. Who were the populists? Populists were dirt farmers, essentially starting in Texas. That's where the first populists were. And the dirt farmers in Texas were not happy about one thing. They were unhappy about a lot of things, but the main thing they were unhappy about was this thing called the crop lien system after the Civil War. After the Civil War, most of the South, in the words of one historian, was a giant pawn shop. There were no banks or lending institutions in most parts of the South. For example, in Georgia, you had something like 33 counties without any banks. So there's no place to get traditional credit. Farmers need credit. Farmers need credit to buy machinery, to buy seeds, to be able to plant the crop, to harvest the crop, and also to be carried over during crop time until harvest comes in to pay those debts. So instead of going to a bank like we do today, or the Farm Service Agency, or one of those institutions, banking institutions or lending institutions, they went instead to something called a furnishing agent, or a furnishing merchant, used interchangeably. These were private folks who were set up as merchants and who worked with the northern banks who lent to the furnishing agents and the merchants, who then provided credit to the farmers. Okay? Now, because there were no banks around, there was no choice but to go through the furnishing agent to get the monies needed for equipment, machinery, food, clothing, those types of things during the year before the harvest came in. These furnishing agents charged the farmers 100 to 200% interest on the monies that they loaned. Farmers had no other choice but to go through them. Not only this, but they also marked up the products by another 50 to 100%, depending on where you read. The furnishing agent's point in charging this, kind of like the company store. Farmer would go in at the beginning of the year, there'd be a ledger book. And the ledger book would keep the debt running of the farmer. Farmer would go in, buy the seeds, buy the equipment, buy the stuff he needs for the year. The furnishing agent would keep the ledger about what kind of debts the farmer owed. When harvest time came around, there was something called settling up time. And settling up time usually wasn't too favorable to the farmer. Because the farmer's crops that they brought in at the end of harvest wouldn't satisfy the ledger debts. Because one reason was this increased rate of interest, that there was no way to pay it back. And in fact, that was the purpose, was not to be able to pay it back. Because after 8 years of harvesting and not being able to settle the ledgers, the furnishing agents took the land. They took the land. Because the debt owed was equal to the amount of the land. So the furnishing agents, some of them in the South, had 600, 1,000, 1,500 farms that the farmers who once owned the land were now sharecroppers on the land employed by the furnishing agent. Okay? It's a way of separating farmers from their land. Okay? That's essentially, it was a process, and it was called the crop lien system. It was done with full knowledge by the northern banks who were propping up these furnishing agents and no other venue for the farmers to go to get credit, to get lending, to provide their needs to get through the farm season. Now, these farmers came together in Texas, called the Farmers Alliance. That was the original name. They didn't become known as the Populists until later. Farmers Alliance came together and said, well, this doesn't seem quite fair. We're watching our neighbors lose their land. We have 6, 8 good years, and then the land goes, and then we become sharecroppers on our own land sometimes. And they said, we have to fix this somehow. So in true self-help fashion, they looked at the situation. They said, what can we do to better our position, better our situation? And they came up with this concept of cooperatives. It's actually where the word cooperatives comes from. Instead of competition, which they saw what happened when you had competition on a pure market basis, that there was something called cooperation. They were going to move on a different basis. Well, what the cooperatives were that they set up were warehouses. Because they were caught in a bind, because when harvest time came, most of the buyers of the cotton and tobacco and other crops that they were raising knew when to come to the farmers to buy. And so the buyers depressed the prices because the farmers were all competing against each other because the crops would come up for harvest within the same couple-week period. So what the Farmers Alliance did was they set up community warehouses, dry warehouses, where they could store the harvest to extend the sales time to move the product onto the market, thereby getting themselves a better price on the sales side so that when buyers came, they could up the price or increase the amount that they were getting because they were no longer at the behest of the buyers coming in because they could keep their crops for a longer time in these warehouses. Also allowed them to do bulk sales to foreign buyers. English buyers, for example, that came into the South to buy didn't like having to go to 50 different farmers to pick up the harvest. This way they could bulk cotton, for example, within the warehouses and sell in bulk to foreign buyers that would come in, thus increasing the prices. However, anybody looking at this would say, well, that's great, it gets them a better price, but it doesn't take care of this. You know, they're still getting screwed halfway to Sunday, and because they're increasing the sales price, but this isn't enough to stop what's happening here in terms of the extension of credit being done at 200, 100, 200% interest rate. So this was allowing them to keep their farms a couple years longer, but people were still going out of business because they were still losing their land to the furnishing agents because they couldn't do anything about the credit situation. So then the Farmers Alliance sat down, and by this time the Farmers Alliance was pretty sizable. This is, you know, we talk about the populists and we try to imagine what the populists were, the Farmers Alliance was. As they went through each of these steps, their numbers kept growing. People loved to join, farmers joined into this cooperative warehouses because they got something out of it. There was a benefit. They could participate in the alliance warehouses and the cooperative purchasing. So there was an automatic benefit to belonging to the group. It's not like sending $30 in and getting a newsletter quarterly from an environmental group or from another group. It's much different because there's a huge benefit financial that folks were getting from participating in the Farmers Alliance. Farmers Alliance sat down and started talking about the credit side, what they could do to fix the credit side of things, not just the sales. They came up with this thing called a Texas Exchange. And the Texas Exchange was the concept that if enough of them came together, kind of going back to what Joe said earlier, if enough of them came together, these farmers across the United States, because by now they moved out of Texas, they organized as far north as New York, and as far north on the western side as Oregon. At one point, they had 40,000 lecturers fanned out across the United States, talking about cooperative warehousing, talking about moving into other ways in which farmers could cooperate with each other to get out from under this process and under the system. 40,000 lecturers. We have 7. 40,000 lecturers fanned out across the United States. So they started, the Texas Exchange was a concept that if all the farmers came together and pooled their assets and their resources and pledged their land as collateral together, collectively, that they could then go to the northern banks, and the northern banks would circumvent the furnishing agents and give them credit at a much reduced rate because they were dealing with them as bulk, in bulk farmers, farmers coming together to say again? Yeah.
It's an aggregation.
Yes, aggregation. Of folks coming together, pledging their land as collateral to obtain the credit to circumvent the furnishing agent. It worked for 1 year. And it worked for 1 year because the northern banks started to crack down on lending. They said, we don't want to foster the formation of this direct credit line because we're making plenty of money up here. And we don't really want to slit our throat by dealing with you folks directly. So the Texas Exchange had problem getting lines of credit. They couldn't get enough credit to do the job that they needed to do, even though they had the combined collateral. So this is when the banks cracked down. Because of this, the populace and the Farmers Alliance radicalized. In other words, there were folks doing that throughout this process, but this was the big one. When they said, well, this really means that government is really operating not for us. In other words, that there's a very few number of people making decisions about what agriculture is going to look like and how we get loans and how loans are done and what interest rates are charged. That it's really a few using the law and using the system to govern the many, which is the many farmers who are trying to make a living in different parts of the country. And it was then that they decided that there were no shortcuts. That self-help was great, but it was only going so far because the structure needed to be changed. And to change the structure, they came up with this grand plan. And the grand plan was to use the federal government and replace the furnishing agents with the federal government. That the federal government would provide warehouses for the farmers. Federal government's cost. The federal government would issue treasury notes, which would give 1 to 3% interest rates for borrowing money. Essentially, the federal government would become the guarantor. The Farmers Alliance knew that to put this into gear, that they had to take over the government, that there were no shortcuts, that they couldn't beg and plead legislators to put something into gear. And so they formed the People's Party. That's where we know the People's Party from. And they came awfully close. They took control of several state legislatures. They elected folks to Congress. There was a populist alliance within the Congress, a caucus of sorts. And they came very, very, very close to implementing some of this into gear. The reason why we don't learn about the populists, and essentially just to go back, they were attempting to use government and law to inure and protect the many over the few. And it's essentially the conclusion that they came to and the reason why they did this work. The reason why you don't read about the populists is because the populists were crushed. Okay? Not just through violence, lynchings and shootings and all kinds of good stuff, that populace in the South died in fairly large numbers. But they got crushed for another reason. They got crushed by a group of people, and what some folks would say a movement of people, known as the progressives.
Hence the name change. Now you know why my comment came
from. The progressives accepted as inevitable that the corporate form was the socioeconomic fabric that was going to propel this nation. These were the efficiency experts. The academics, the scientists, the folks.
We don't have stationery yet, do we? There's a book put out by Lawrence Goodwin. It's called The Populist Moment. It is a history, much more than this 5 minutes, but it hits, oh, Rachel has her hand up with it. That's what the book looks like. It's Populist Moment. It is a fascinating read, and folks should get it, because the populist is really the last movement in this country that sought to take it all on. And Lawrence Goodwin uses the phrase, these were folks that dared to aspire grandly. And there are stories told about the populist gatherings where you had wagon trains stretching for miles outside of town. They had mass gatherings, mass educational events. They had their own newspaper association that was putting out newspapers across the country. They had these 40,000 lecturers that were being trained and were out speaking with each other, getting them into the warehousing and the cooperative system, and finally moving the People's Party, which actually made a play. The last time in this country that folks made a play for taking this place. Not taking it back, because I'm not so sure we ever had it in the first place, but actually using government for the many over the few.
What year was it?
The populists generally list as starting 1894, 1895. There were some remnants of it much earlier in the 1800s. Most people pegged the death of it as 1898, 1899.
And because of that year, you have to put in perspective that 40,000 lecturers today would be 120,000,
150,000
lecturers.
Or more. So we're going to hear from Hiram Simonton.
I just wanted to make one more comment about another thing that I think is of great interest is that
one of the reasons that it failed is because the Populist Party decided to join with the Democratic Party. And they got diffused, they got broken up, and the Democrats just took them over. So think about it, folks.
Oh, my God.
Well, yeah, the populist moment, of course, is now worldwide. It's this very same scenario as that was taking place with the Texas farmers is now happening all around the world. It's exactly the same method of grabbing their land and resources.
Yes, and in essence, the Commerce Clause in our Constitution is the model that we export out into the international trade agreements, because it is, in essence, about destroying the ability of democratically controlling production, commerce, and trade. That's what it is. Hiram Simonton is actually Bill Smedley, who is going to join us this weekend. I think Pennsylvania is the only state crazy enough to give Bill a badge to be a constable. He's an elected constable in Pennsylvania.
Howdy. Greetings from Hayward County, South Carolina.
This is a prototype of a tape we're making for the curriculum.
I'm Hiram Simonton, and the good folks from something called Democracy Schools asked me to speak to you directly today about the Farmers' Alliance and what you folks call the populist moment in the history of these United States. I suppose it was what you folks would call a movement, but for us, it was about survival. In preparation for talking to you today, I dug out my receipts from when I used to grow cotton in this county to show you what I mean when I say survival. You see, farmers like me, with about 40 acres of cotton crop, were forced by the lack of access to credit to rely on folks called furnishing agents to get us through each year. For food, supplies, farm tools, clothing for the youngins, and me and the missus had four of those, we ain't never had the cash to buy all that stuff. The agent, and mine was the furnishing house of T.G. Patrick right up the road, furnished us with everything we needed throughout the year, and then settled up with us when harvest time come. Then furnishing agents, like old T.G., worked with the northern banks and merchants, who supplied them agents with the goods that they rented to us, the bill for which came due to us at settling up time. Problem was, settling up each year put us further and further into the hole. But it weren't the fall in price of cotton that did us in. It was that old T.G. Patrick, who furnished for almost all of the cotton farmers in the county, made us put our land up as collateral each year for the opportunity of getting credit from him. Why, he then proceeded to charge us double or triple the actual cash price of goods credited during the year. And on top of that, imagine that old devil TG charged us interest on top of that. In 1884, we ran up a credit bill of $916.63 at TG's store, which included 35% interest on what we bought, on top of the inflated prices he was already charging us and farmers down the road. And at settling up time, my cotton brought only $307.31. We settled the difference by giving him a note on our land. We ain't had no other choice. Deeper down the hole we went each year. That's what settling up came to mean till 1891, when we defaulted to old TG in an amount equal to the price of our land. He then took our land to pay those debts. I'll bet he took 100 farms that year to settle up with farmers, and at one point he was enslaving over 300 sharecroppers on what was once their own farms. You folks probably flinch when I speak of slavery and enslavement. Well, we white farmers in the 1880s was enslaved, no doubt about it. So were city workers, carpenters, hoopers, coopers, teamsters, all of them. At the bottom, and we was at the bottom, we was all laborers. And TG and his old system was driving us further into the hole, making us landless serfs on what was our own property. It wasn't just us, of course. It ain't no surprise that we all lost our land. It took the Alliance folks to show us that we weren't alone, though, and that it wasn't our fault. It was the system and the law. Through them, we saw hundreds of thousands of farm families going through the same thing. The Lions folks called this here credit process a crop lien system, by which farmers like me all across the South lost their land to merchants who ended up managing tens of thousands of sharecroppers on their newly acquired land. It's no wonder that old TG ended up so rich in the pocket. Folks like TG done run the South for years after the Civil War. I hear tell that Massachusetts alone had 5 times as much circulation of them private banknotes than the entire South. I even heard that from them Alliance lectures that 123 counties in the state of Georgia ain't got no banks at all. Larry Goodwin, that good feller who wrote a book about us, even said that the South was one giant pawn shop after the Civil War, with northern merchants sucking out dollar signs from folks like me. You see, by controlling money and the money system, they controlled us. They was backed by banks and laws, and we wasn't backed by nothing. And that's where the Alliance came in. They started in Texas, then took this county and others by storm with tens of thousands of Alliance lectures. Them lectures connected the dots for us that we were at the mercy of folks like old TG, who was backed by them northern banks and merchants. It was a fixed system, and we was the ones suffering to fill the pockets of them few. And let me tell you why I and my neighbors joined. We didn't see no other choice. They gave us something no one else was given: hope. We partnered with them Alliance boys to build ourselves some warehouses. Instead of letting those cotton buyers depress the prices for our crop, because harvest time was the same for everyone, we let that cotton sit in those dry storage warehouses till cotton prices rose. We even attracted some foreign buyers by bulking our cotton together at the state level to get better prices. We joined together in things called cooperatives, cooperating with each other to drive costs down for farm equipment by buying equipment altogether. course, our work ain't done nothing to get rid of folks like old TG and the old boy bankers behind him. We was just playing with the knobs, still living with the crop lien, just drawing out the years that we had with our land. And folks like TG couldn't even let us have the cooperatives. Buyers and sellers connected with the big northern merchants' houses stopped dealing with us at the request of the Furnishing Agents Association. Pretty soon, we was back where we started, because others controlled our lives more than we did. Them Alliance fellas in Texas were pretty bright, though. We watched as they put together the Texas Exchange. What was that? I'll tell you. It was a way to get rid of them furnishing agents. Instead of folks like old TG renting us credit and us enriching the banking and goods corporations behind them, them Texas farmers signed collateral notes on their farms over to the Alliance itself. On the basis of those notes, the Alliance then borrowed capital at a decent rate, because they had enough collective collateral to get those rates, and then used the capital to buy years' worth of food, supplies, farm equipment, and the rest for the farmers. Then crops came in and were sold collectively, I might add, through the lines. The collateral notes were paid off, and farmers like me got paid. Shoot, the Alliance promised to free all of us from all the TGs and them folks behind the old TG and his ilk across the South. Instead of paying 100 to 200% more than what our goods were worth, farmers in the exchange would end up paying only 5% on the goods they bought on credit. Sound good? It was too good. We found out, I tell you, them Alliance folks we partnered with fought for us tooth and nail. But those big bank boys weren't stupid. They knew that the exchange threatened their corporate banking system. Even with all that collateral, those bank boys wouldn't provide enough capital for the operation of the exchange. And that's when the call went out from Texas round the line states. I can still remember it, even today. Farmers who didn't have spit ponied up to save the exchange from failing. Women dug up their bags of meager savings. It was June 9th, 1888, and we sent whatever we had to give. In over 200 Texas counties, farm wagons lined up outside of county courthouses and outside of the county lines to come together to donate money to save the exchange. Because of that, and for no other reason, the exchange survived that year, but crashed the next. Always the same goddamn reason, not enough credit, because those bank boys wouldn't loan money to the exchange. That could have been the end of the Alliance, but it wasn't. In many ways, we all had the experience that before we admitted to ourselves what we had to do, them Alliance fellers knew what had to happen. We had to clean out this here crop lien system once and for all, which meant breaking old TG's sole claim to credit and breaking the hold of old TG's puppeteers. I learned a lot during them years, how the law could be used by a small group of fellers to enslave the majority of folks working. In 1889, them Alliance fellers proposed a new plan. It was pretty bold, but them was bold times, you know. We had hundreds of thousands of farmers joined together, first out of desperation, then out of hope, because they had begun to understand that why they was the many being ground down by the few. And that ain't what the American Revolution was all about. We all began working on this new plan, which called the federal government to issue treasury notes. We call them greenbacks, like the greenbacks issued during the war between the states. Those treasury notes would be provided by the value of our crops, and we'd pay 2% interest on those notes, which we could use to buy food, supplies, and other necessities for our family during the year. Looking back on it, made a whole lot of sense. We was replacing the furnishing agents with government, except we understood that for the plan to work, we had to get involved in this self-government stuff by spending time studying and organizing so we can make our governments run by the majority of farmers and workers in these United States. We came to learn that the Republican and Democrat parties were run by folks like old TG, who had turned their backs on us farmers. They called us hayseeds in their party back rooms, I understand. We knew in our hearts that we had to become political to get what we needed, that there was no other way around it, to put the system in place that we wanted, that the majority wanted. We needed to make government run by us. And that's when the People's Party launched itself in a way that no other party had in these states. It was exciting times, and I was part of it all with the Hayward County Alliance. But them banking corporations and everything tied to them ground us down. We elected folks, but not enough, because them corporations mustered everything they had to grind us down. Not content with that, they worked to erase the Alliance folks from your history books. Old TG and the banks behind him took my land in 1891. They took old Hess's land the next month and old Bingman's land a year or two later. Old TG retired, and we now got a new furnishing agent in town, and so it started up all over again, this time with the farmers that were still left. All I hope is that you fellas and gals learn from what happened to us. I understand that the TGs of the world are even more trenched than they were here. You got a good fight ahead of you, and this old farmer wishes you well. Now I got to get back to work. Good luck, you democracy folks, and remember the hopes and struggles of the Alliance.
Actually developed from Hiram's Dire. So Hiram was a real person, and his dire is one of the populist diaries, which we found and read through.
This is where my recording stopped, because I was not allowed to record the rest. But there is more. Townships in Pennsylvania are making laws to disallow corporate personhood in their jurisdictions, insisting on local control. More on this in future programs. To become involved in spreading the democracy movement in New York State through the establishment of ongoing democracy schools, contact Rachel at area code 607-569-2114, 607-569-2114. To contact CellDef directly, visit their website at celldef.org. That's celldef.org. You can download this and prior episodes of this show in MP3 at our website archive at www.unwelcomeguests.org. And our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
My end, for my guns and my saddle will always